This is Metal Mike, and I welcome you to the A-Fish Motley 94 Spectacular. Whoa, are you excited? Hey, are you a Motley Crue fan? Are you a fan of their 1994 album with Karabi? Well, if you are, then this is the show for you. I'm joined by my Twitter pal, A-Fish, and he is a mega fan of this album. Together we talk through the lead-up, Vince's departure and solo album, the 1994 album, its aftermath, all kinds of what-ifs, you name it, man, it's all here. And there's cool sound clips and interviews sprinkled in to enhance this epic trip back in time. Now, totally off topic, if you are a Kiss fan, check out me and my buds doing a cover of I from The Elder. That's over on YouTube. But now, it's time to go on a hooligan's holiday with Mr. A-Fish and explore the glorious Motley 94. Check it out.
Well, Fish, welcome to the 80s Glam Metal Cast. How you doing, brother?
Man, glad to be here. Honored to be on a podcast with Metal Mike, for sure.
And this is going to be the A-Fish Motley 94 Spectacular. So it's going to be huge. So you are big into this album. I am too. But I always notice that when there's an opportunity to talk about Motley Crue or talk about this album, you always chime in about this, about John Karabi. What caught your ears with this album? Why do you love this album so much?
I personally think it's the best Motley release of them all. I think Nicky was probably tired of doing all the hard work in the band. Who knows what really happened between the band and Vince, but I do know I was into Karabi with the Scream back before any of this went down. I think I've sent you a picture of this, but I had a personalized license plate of one of their songs, I Believe in Me, and I just really dug that guy from the get-go, man. Just I thought the Scream was great. I liked his voice, the power, the, you know, everything he could do. I thought the Scream should have been a lot bigger. Now we can talk about, you could do a whole podcast on bands that should have been bigger.
There's a lot of those.
You know, like everyone, there was no 24-hour news cycle online back in the day. I found out through Metal Edge magazine that Karabi was announced as the new singer. I mean, it's not instantaneous like it is nowadays when somebody quits the band or the statement the same day. That was not the case. And right. I just knew Karabi from the Scream back in the day. And when I found out he was going to be the new singer, I thought it was a great move. I mean, at that point, I had grown pretty tired of Motley Crue, to be honest with you, especially even though it sold millions, especially Dr. Feelgood.
Sure. Let's jump into it, man. Let's kind of go through a timeline. So in your opinion, in some conversations that we had, you feel like the cracks are starting to show at Dr. Feelgood, which is surprising because Dr. Feelgood is like their pinnacle, right? The commercial pinnacle. What about this? What do you feel? What's wrong with Dr. Feelgood in your opinion?
Commercial pinnacle, man. I'm not a fan of Hysteria either, but it sold millions of copies, and just like Dr. Feelgood sold millions of copies. That album, I was pretty excited when I heard it was coming out, and I got it, and it just felt like a letdown to me. I mean, there were some catchy singles, and of course they released every catchy single.
Right.
But the overall song quality, you've seen in some of my tweets where I call it Nicky filler. I mean, the Time for Change and Slice of Your Pie, Rattlesnake Shake, Sticky Sweet, She Goes Down. I mean, that's just repetitive and right. just garbage, in my opinion. I just thought he had either run out of ideas or they could just put out whatever they want at that point and it would sell 5 million copies, because there are some bad songs on Dr. Feelgood.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. Now, let's put it in perspective. I bought this when it came out in 89. I was 13 years old. So for me, like, this all made sense. And I probably thought it was their best album when I, as a kid, you know, I was like, oh, this is great. You know, big sound, big singles. But
I agree with what you're saying. When I go back to it with my adult ears, like the only songs that I really have much tolerance for are the singles. Like I don't like Sticky Sweet and Rattlesnake Shit. You know what I mean? You're right. These are your atypical, you know, 80s metal sex tunes or whatever. You know, they're just, there's nothing really original about any of them. And, you know, you try to stack that up against Too Fast for Love or Shout at the Devil, there's no comparison. So it was the right album. For the time, for the year, obviously, it sold 6 million copies, you know what I mean? And here's the thing, Fish, about Motley Crue, which might be a hindrance to them, you know, in their mindset, is that every album they do, they keep getting bigger, right? I feel like where, like, Rat was, like, really big when they came out, and then every album started to sell a little bit less. Crue sold more, I think, with every single album. You know, from Too Fast for Love to Dr. Feelgood, the sales just keep going up. And overall, I gotta admit, I do think Dr. Feelgood's a better album than Girls, Girls, Girls. So I think the Nikki filler that you're talking about has, you know, starts after Shout at the Devil. You know what I mean? Even though I love all these albums because they were like my childhood, this was one of my favorite bands. A lot of that Nikki filler, you know, is seeping in from Theater of Pain on. But, you know, I think the bad part of this is that I think the Crue, or maybe even in Nikki's mind, it's like I think they can do no wrong because you keep putting something out and it keeps getting bigger. You know what I mean? You know, it almost seems like it's destined to fail at some point. And that's coming, right? It is. There is going to be commercial failure as we go on. But yeah, I think that's the only danger. And the other thing that's kind of dangerous is when you think about, you talk about some of these songs, like these filler, these cheesy songs, they work in 89, but what would they do to your reputation in 92 and 90, you know, 93, you know what I'm trying to say? It's like Cherry Pie, Dog Eat Dog, incredible album by Warrant, but nobody could get past Cherry Pie. You know what I mean? It was big in 90, but it was really wrong. And it was one of those things that people pointed the finger at, like, this is what's wrong with this genre, you know? So I think Crue played into some of that, and I think some of it bit them, you know, as we got into the 90s.
At least the group showed they still have a sense of humor when asked about women, fire, and hairspray, the main components of their videos in years past.
Dude, that is a stupid question.
Dr. Feelgood wasn't like that.
You know what?
Let's
knock the interview off.
This is getting really stupid. Women, hairspray, and fire?
I totally agree. I was a fan of Motley early, not as early. I picked up Shout after I picked up Theater of Pain. Mm-hmm. And Shout is a great album. I think that it's just a solid album. You know, it's interesting. Motley uses different logos and different themes and dress different for almost every album. So they kind of had the, you know, unlike Kiss, which is the same KISS since day one, Motley has a lot of different logos. And,
yep.
You know, they changed their image and changed some of their songs. But I, back in the day, in 89, I was 20. I was just burnt out on the Crue. Still Good burnt me out. I didn't even go see that tour. Mm-hmm. And I loved them. And I think Faster Pussycat opened. But I was just tired of them at that point. And I just think creatively they were running out of ideas. And you know, who am I to judge? Because it sold millions of copies. But I just was disappointed in the entire album, honestly.
Yeah. So obviously they get through that tour, super huge. Somebody's bright idea, and once again, this could be a misstep in the scheme of things, but the bright idea is in 91, because usually Crue's doing a new album every 2 years, but in 91, we're doing a greatest hits package. One new song, there's a few new songs on there, but the song that really stands out to most people is Primal Scream. Angela sounds like it's a leftover from Dr. Feelgood, you know, and then Anarchy in the UK. Never really worked for me. I don't see Crue as a punk band. I know Nikki likes to think they are punk, but, or there's a punk influence there, but I don't know if I really feel it the way he does. But I'll be honest, man, I didn't buy this album when it came out at first. I think I waited a couple years because I had all this shit. What did you think of Decade?
I think Decade of Decadence, basically when bands run out of ideas, I think they release compilations or greatest hits packages, and that may go against, you know, and I like greatest hits albums, but you have to give me something additional for me to buy. Decade of Decadence, it was a pretty good career retrospective. Nowhere near as complete as Red, White, and Crue years later.
Right.
But I believe Home Sweet Home remix was on that. They tried to squeeze blood out of a stone again with Home Sweet Home, and that was unnecessary in my opinion. I do like Primal Scream. I think that's a great song. I think it's a song that sounds completely different than anything on Feel Good.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was a good direction, to be honest with you. I think that was a really good song. Probably one of my, well, outside of 1994, of course, but one of my favorite songs from Motley was Primal Scream. I like the groove. I like the beat. I just think that is just a fabulous song.
I think the crew was pretty aware that, you know, times were changing. When you look at the crew, you know, if you look at when Feel Good came out in 89, at least from the beginning, crew looked very glam to an extent. Their hair was teased and they had a little makeup on. Like, I'm thinking of the photo shoot where they're in the straight jackets. They looked pretty glammy there. You know what I mean? And when you look at them for Decade of Decadence, everybody's got flat hair, sunglasses, you know, shaved sides, flannels and shorts. You know, I mean, they're embracing this alternative culture that's kind of come along, don't you think?
Yeah, I think bands like Motley were big enough to survive this. A lot of bands were not, but I think Motley understood, you know, they can't get away with same old situation. I mean,
no.
Introduce me to a lover in a cellophane dress. I mean, that's not going to fly a few years later. Now, not 89, nobody even paid attention to that, but in my opinion, that just was not going to fly. And I think the winds had changed, and a lot of bands, Motley included, as big as they were going to be left out in the cold when, not one of my favorites, but when the new grunge sound came into play.
Yeah. Now, this album sold 2 million copies, so Crew's still making some bucks for Elektra Records. I was checking out, before we got on the call, I was checking out some dates, and here's some interesting facts here. So this album came out in October, okay, of 91. Nirvana came out in September of 91. So there's no way really to react to what's going to happen or really know that it's going to become as big as it becomes. Now, let me throw this one at you, because this is kind of, I always love to play like the, I do this a lot on Twitter, like the what ifs and all that stuff. What do you think would have happened if Crew just did a studio album in 91 in the vibe of Primal Scream and all that kind of stuff? How do you think they would have fared? I think at this point, I think they would have done fairly well, not Dr. Feelgood well, but I think there was still some steam left in 91 for them to do something with Vince. What do you think they could have done commercially at that point?
I agree with that. I mean, like I said, Primal is a great song. I'm with you. The rest of that album, I mean, they really picked and chose, what was it, 10 or maybe 15 songs or something? I mean, you know, you could almost put all of Shout on a greatest hits album.
Right.
It was just that good. 91, I was still seeing these shows, and I was still seeing bands in 91, 92, the bands that I like. It just seemed all of a sudden radio quit playing it, MTV quit playing it. It was just like a universal shutoff valve to all 80s metal, rock and roll, glam, whatever you want to call it. And it just, you know, the tide turned, but it just turned quickly. I mean, it just seems like it happened overnight.
Yeah, no, it definitely did. So the next thing that kind of happens from the timelines that I'm seeing out there is in early 92, maybe it's even January, I don't know. I'd have to check in with Paul Miles, my buddy from Australia who writes all the Crew books, but somewhere along the line, right, Crew signs a $35 million deal in the beginning of 92. So Elektra Records, whoever's running the show at that point, feels like Motley Crue can still make them a lot of money. And then shortly after this all happens, Vince is out. So this has got to be, people got to be shitting their pants, right, at Elektra Records, because this is gamble time, right? This is a big gamble that could be coming. Let's talk about the Vince leaving, fired. Well, what do you think? I mean, it's never been really cleared up. It's not cleared up really much in the dirt.
Can you tell
what's your take
on it? The true story, and was it a hostile breakup?
Well, I mean, there was a lot of rumors. It wasn't a hostile breakup or anything. It was the band did what they thought was right. You know, I really didn't like the direction that the music was going into, and I really wasn't enthused about it. And So they thought that they should look for another singer. So it was kind of a, and I'm not really bitter about it at all. I don't like the way they went about it, but I'm really happy, you know, that they're doing what they want to do, and now it's time for me to move on.
And how did they go about it?
Well, I kind of showed up at rehearsal, and
you just showed up. It was yeah, I'm trying to get an image of what happened here.
Well, it was during the storms, and I showed up at rehearsal, and everybody was upstairs waiting for me with our manager. And
did you get a vibe that something was up?
Yeah, it was like it was really weird, and they said, you know, you're not really enthusiastic about the music, and I go, yeah, you know, you're right about that, and they said, well, I think we're gonna start thinking about looking for a new singer. And I go, well, if that's what you feel, then...
Did your heart just stop?
Well, at first I got angry. You know, that was my first reaction. And then I just said, well, if that's what you guys want, then go ahead. And
did you just leave?
And that was it. That was really...
You just got up and walked out.
Yeah, that was really the end of the story, because it's almost started to turn into like a yelling match. And I didn't want it to end like that. So I thought it best just to leave, just to go away.
When you're
I think this
down.
Was the time that Vince started getting heavy into racing. I know Vince was going doing that. Nikki, as you know, did almost 100% of the writing on most Motley albums. Vince would come in and sing, and I don't think he offered anything additional other than his voice. And I think, you know, I think you're probably right. That was some pressure that the band was under. With that contract, and maybe that had something to do with it. Maybe Motley or maybe Nikki was wanting to change the direction a little bit, and Vince Neil was hesitant to go along with that. I don't think we will ever know exactly what happened. I mean, each side has had plenty of opportunities to get their own word out, and, you know, basically it comes down to they fired me and no, you quit, and that's pretty much the way it was left. I mean, I can agree with you there.
The thing is, when I talk with Paul Miles, and, you know, like I said, he's the guy who wrote the book with Karabi, and he's basically like a biographer of Crew. And he said,
I'm all about that.
Yeah.
That's pre-ordered right now.
Nice. So when I talked with him, he kind of said it was, you know, it was almost like a mutual type of a thing where, you know, Vince was partying hard. Beyond the racing thing, he was getting wasted again. So the sobriety thing was over, and he wasn't showing up for stuff, and they were getting pissed off. And once again, you talk about the pressure. You know, we got this deal. We got to make another hit record. This guy seems like he's checking out. And you got to admit, man, all this time being together, people probably getting sick of each other, sick of each other's bullshit. And this one says screw you. This one says screw you. And it's almost like something escalates, you know, maybe to a level that it never should have got to. But here's another thing, Fish, that I think about. And once again, I don't know if this is true. This is just my own speculation. I think people get in your head, right? No one's going to tell me that people didn't say to Vince, you could go solo. You could do this on your own, right? And there's probably voices that are with the other guys is like, hey, man, the 80s are over. Vince Neil's like the poster child of the 80s. He's the most 80s looking guy in your band. Get rid of him and you'll be bigger. You know, I think there's voices on either side of the fence that are getting in people's heads. What do you think about that?
That can 100% be true. You know, Vince is the strutty, the blonde hair, the voice, the image. I mean, he is the 80s singer. Him, Bret Michaels, Joe Elliott.
Yep.
Trying to think who am I missing here, but you know, that kind of, you know, the blonde-headed, pouty singer, 80s, metal, glam, all that kind of fits together. And I don't deny that could be the case at all. I think, I think there's always opportunities for people think there's opportunities for a solo career. And, you know, there's, in this kind of band or this kind of situation, you don't have no men. You have yes men.
Yep.
That are agreeing with whatever you're saying, because they've probably been riding the train for quite a few years now. You know, whether or not Nikki started to write different, or Vince was getting trashed or racing, whatever, you know, obviously they were double fuck you, then they were both gone.
Yep.
And so here Motley Crue sat with no singer and a $25 million contract that, you know, all of a sudden, seems like an albatross.
Yeah, and you know what the funny thing is, man, when you look back, you know, whether it was because of the climate of music or people getting sick of each other. I mean, you got Vince Neil out of Crew, you got Joey Belladonna out of Anthrax. You could just go through all of them. Bruce Dickinson out of Maiden, Halford out of Priest. This is all happening within like a 5-year window from like 92 to 97. You know what I mean? And so they all went through it. I wonder if they did it just because, you know, it's almost like in retrospect, we'll get rid of the other guy, we'll do something different, and then when we get the original guy back, then we'll be even bigger. You know what I mean? So you always wonder, you know, was this all orchestrated by somebody, you know, higher with some smarts? I don't know, man. But it's just funny to think how many of these bands did it.
There is definitely a pattern.
For sure.
You mentioned great examples of that entire situation, and it does seem to involve lead singers. So
yeah. It was weird. It was a weird time. So before 1994's Motley Crue album, another album comes out by Vince Neil. So in 93, we got Exposed. I was reading, I guess, at least initially, he got a pretty good contract with Warner Brothers. What do you think of Exposed?
I thought it was a good album. Mm-hmm. I believe, if I remember, Vince was wanting to have it out on the one-year anniversary of the breakup. I don't think that happened, but I remember reading that was what he was wanting to do. You're Invited is a great party anthem. Some of the songs on it were a little cheesy, but
yeah.
You know, there again, we're dealing
now
with Vince Neil.
See where we've gone, and you can see where he's gone. All his stuff's about the chicks and the cars, and we've kind of gone in maybe, I don't know if it's a more serious direction, maybe a realer direction. And I'm really glad I don't have to do that anymore.
So you know, that is not surprising to me. But overall, I bought Exposed. I thought it was really good.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's a weird album because it pays no attention to what's going on with music. Obviously, it's 93, so we're deep into grunge, man. Nirvana and all that stuff is taking over. But Vince has completely almost made the follow-up to the true follow-up to Dr. Feelgood, you know what I mean? It's got a lot of that corniness. But strangely enough, there is a lot of interesting depth on that album. There's some really heavy songs, and Steve Stevens has some real killer guitar work. So there's some cool shit on that album, like The Edge, Look in Her Eyes, Can't Change Me,
yep.
Living is a Luxury. I do really love that album. Strangely enough, I did not buy that one either when it first came out, because I think even I was like, this sounds kind of cheesy. Some of these songs, like Can't Have Your Cake and Eat It Too, some of the stuff, you know, I was like, this is kind of cheesy. And then maybe about a year after it came out, I think I was on like used tape, you know, clearance rack or something like that, and I bought it, and I was like, man, this album's pretty damn good. I was wrong not to pick this up when it first came out. But and now to this day, I really, really love it. And I'm a Vince Neil nut, man. And this is where we might butt heads when we get into the Karabi discussion, because I really do love Vince Neil's my favorite guy. I love his voice. I know he's not the most incredible singer on the planet, but he's just got a cool, distinct voice. It's something, it's like the voice of my childhood. I grew up with that voice. You know what I'm trying to say? So
yep.
So he's always, you know, and I think that's probably going to be some of the unraveling of Motley Crue, you know, as we go forward. So, well, let's not open up that can of worms yet. 1994, Motley Crue, it comes out, man. You buy it. What are your thoughts? You blown away? You're loving it? What's going on?
Absolutely blown away. Still can recall the day, just the power to the music came on, and I was just like, what in the hell? It just sounded unlike any Motley Crue sound that I had heard, and then Karabi kicked in, and I think he gave the band really a jolt of creativity.
It's just strong. It's just better. Better, faster, louder.
And I think as far as like a new beginning, you know, there's a little bit of excitement with us. You know, Tommy and the guys all get excited or whatever, because I'm experiencing things for the first time.
Yeah.
So
maybe that
kind of makes it
like a new band.
Right.
Let's talk about this album a little bit, man. I know you're big into it. I'm into it too. What are some key things you think Karabi brought into this thing?
Well, I think he brought in just a new attitude. His musical skills, writing ability, guitar playing ability. I mean, this guy's pretty multi-talented. I know I'm biased, but he's a pretty talented dude. And, you know, in my opinion, he just added, you know, this new, it's more than just a lead singer. And I think that's what Vince had been for all those years, just a lead singer. No contributions musically, lyrically. And I think Corabi brought all of that actually to Motley for the first time.
Yeah. I mean, you know, obviously the voice is completely different. It's very raspy. It can be very bluesy. And it fits well with the heavier sounds that they were going for. But, you know, there's a times where it also is very commercial. You know, I mean, it sounds like it could work. You know, I mean, the harmonies all sound really great. And I think it works. It's definitely not, and maybe it wasn't for everybody, but I thought it sounded pretty damn good.
You just push play. There's no filler on this album.
No. And I think the songs have a lot of different dimensions to them. You know what I mean? And when you go through this album where, you know, like if you, let's say an album like Girls, 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 it's pretty static, right? It doesn't change all that much. Maybe You're All I Need, you know, you got the ballad, but it's pretty straightforward. Where this goes into a lot of cool places. I mean, there's real heavy elements to it. There's bluesy elements. There's times where it's almost psychedelic or, you know, Beatles-y. So they really go and try some different things that they've never tried before.
100% agree. Mick was unbelievable on this album. Tommy's Tommy, great drummer. But I think Corabi pushed him lyrically and musically to a different and better direction, in my opinion.
You know, lyrically, it's probably no comparison because, you know, we talked earlier about Dr. Feelgood and Sticky Sweet and Slice of Your Pie, and these are like the most stereotypical, goofy, you know, sex songs that you could ever think of. And now we're really getting into some deep stuff, you know. I mean, we're talking about, you know, people contemplating suicide, and we got Dropping Like Flies, and we're getting into some deeper social stuff than we really probably...
The whole chick party thing is not part of what we're about anymore. It's about totally. Now. It's not about then. That's over. It's dead. It's past tense. You know, you can't live in the past.
Never have before.
Without a question. I mean, I'm anxiously awaiting the Corabi autobiography next month. But, you know, I think he in there mentioned Uncle Jack, which apparently is a true story.
Right.
Of his someone in his family, uncle or something, that was, you know, taking advantage of kids when they were young, and they wrote a song about that. I mean, there's no way Vince could pull that off.
Right.
I mean, it's just the anger. You know, let me run the razor across your throat. I mean, it's just a blow to the head, man. It's just a whole separate sound.
Yeah. And, you know, one thing you could say, too, is it does kind of harken back to maybe some of the earlier Motley Crue themes. Because if you look at Shout at the Devil, there's a lot of, like, anger and darkness on those lyrics, but that kind of thing kind of went away as you got, you know, later on, you know, as you got to Feel Good and stuff like that. So it was definitely hearkening back to some of that stuff too, where, you know, Nicky had no problem, you know, doing some dark tunes, of course, you know.
Yeah, he's a pretty messed up dude. I've got some of his books, man. You know, 6 a.m. you know, was one of his side projects, which is kind of out there a little bit. But yeah, as soon as Theater Pain and 85-ish, the glam look, and then that went through Girls, 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 and the Dr. Feelgood. I mean, honestly, there's as many, in my opinion, good songs as there are throwaway songs on all three of those albums. I just think those albums are bloated with none songs.
I've got a couple that I'm going to throw out there, and then I'll have you do the same. I mean, obviously, I think Power to the Music is a great song. Especially, I think the chorus-wise, it still kind of feels familiar, you know, as the Motley Crue that we know with those big choruses. But there's something different there, and it's just a cool kickoff to the album. Obviously, Hooligan's Holiday, great tune, you know, catchy, you know. Obviously, maybe, you know, if you could dial back Motley Crue, but here I am doing this what if stuff, you know. Maybe if this album could have came out in '90 before everything imploded, you know, that maybe could have been a hit in that era. But, you know, for the era that we're in, there's probably no chance of Crue to have a hit. But, you know, that it is a cool single. Misunderstood is so cool, and I think this kind of goes back to this you know, experimental type stuff, because this is where you feel like it's got some backwards guitars and some Beatles-y stuff, the way the music's kind of panned as it starts off. You know, that's, you hear a lot of experimenting. Poison Apples, I always thought was definitely a kind of a throwback to the older Crew sound. You know, I can picture Vince maybe singing the chorus to that one. I felt like that was kind of close.
Trying to.
Yeah. Hammered is cool. Till Death Do Us Part, I think, is awesome. Slow, heavy, you know, type of song. And then I'll just end it off with Smoke the Sky. I mean, super, super fast, super, super heavy. It's like taking Kickstart My Heart and, you know, ramping it up like, you know, times 100 or something like that. So those are ones that kind of stand out to me. Probably some of those same ones stand out to you. What do you got to throw out? What do you think of some songs?
The power to the music is just a sledgehammer starting off. I mean, just the tone and the drums and Karabi's voice and Nikki's bottom end. I mean, it's just, you know, I remember listening to it, but whoa. I mean, just like, okay, you know, we're on to something here.
We're setting the tone.
And I'm with you. Yeah, it's just incredible, that bottom end. Looking Holiday, like you mentioned, catchy as hell. I don't quite get how that didn't make it. You know, release kind of a rocker and then a ballad and then a big rocker, which I think the official third single was Smoke the Sky. I think, I don't think the video ever got played, but I think that was officially or unofficially the third single. But yeah, you know, Drift Away I love, Misunderstood I love, Till Death Do Us Part. If you weren't going to mention that one, I was. just the menacing tone of that song, just the, you know, just the undertones of it, man. It's just, you know, dropping like flies. I mean, they're bouncing off my head, but, you know, anything and everything. You know, Uncle Jack is a scary song. I mean, it's a great song, but, I mean, the subject is just out there, man, especially for Motley Crue after listening to Dr. Feelgood and all that garbage, in my opinion.
No, I was looking for some thing that I read that Vince said, and it took me a while to find it, but I did find it. And this was something that he put out maybe about the time he was promoting the Exposed album. And he says he was really ousted because he wasn't a blues guy. And the rest of the band very much wanted to be blues. At least that's what he's saying at the time, you know, 91, 92. He said, we've been rehearsing for a few months, but we didn't record anything. It just wasn't sounded good to me. I'm not a blues singer, and Motley is a rock band, not a blues band. I think it's a stupid idea that will alienate the fans. And it's funny, you know, when you listen to the album, I wouldn't say it's, you know, totally bluesy, but, you know, Love Shine, I feel like it's very bluesy. And I think there's parts of Misunderstood that kind of are bluesy. And it makes me wonder, you know, like, what were they trying to do at that point? Or were they really just trying to go a direction that they knew he couldn't go and this was not going to make it much longer? I don't really know, you know, but that's what he says.
Yeah, I would take probably on both sides their versions with a grain of salt. There's some pretty rough stuff out there, them talking about Vince during those couple of years. But, you know, honestly, I may have mentioned this or some degree of it. You know, I think, you know, there was a newfound energy in this band that they could do something different and do something outside, quote unquote, of the Motley Crue realm.
Now, obviously, I think I might know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask it anyways, but we'll discuss it. Now, do you think Karabi was unfairly blamed for the commercial failure of this album?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the easy, you know, we sold 6 million copies of Feel Good and, you know, 500,000 of this. What changed? We changed singers.
Right.
I don't think an album with Vince in 94 with that era would have done very well either, to be honest with you. But, you know, I think, you know, Elektra, you know, from some of the stuff I've read and kind of researched, the musical era was undergoing a lot of changes, and I think a lot of changes were getting being done at some of the record labels and record companies. I think a lot of people that, you know, signed a lot of bands, maybe 80s bands, late 80s bands, a lot of those people were being shifted out of positions or downsized or whatever the case may be. I mean, and it was bloated. It, you know, there was copies of copies of copies of bands by the time you reached 90, 91. You know, there wasn't a whole lot left out there that was original. Yeah, I think, you know, Elektra plays a part of this too. They got new ownership. They've got a $25 million contract, and they're like, hey, you know, we need $4 million in sales to break even or whatever the case may be. But, you know, that said, Motley took that heat and took the, you know, the scaled down tour and the low album sales and were like, you know, damn it, we're going to go through with this. I mean, they started a new album with Karate. Song titles are out there. You can research, you know, Personality 9, I think we mentioned, was going to be the name of it. And mm-hmm. just would love to have heard that or hear that. But, you know, I think even through it all, they were like, you know, full speed ahead. They were on their way to album number two with Karate.
Yeah, and what's funny is I want to say when I talked to Paul Miles, he said that Motley 94 has just slightly outsold Generation Swine. I mean, I think they're both gold, but just like I said, they're pretty comparable, you know, with each other. So bringing back Vince wasn't, you know, this big commercial success that they thought it was going to be. And another thing that we should talk about is it sounded like when they were trying to make this follow-up to the 94 album, it's almost like what they wanted to do was kind of erratic. And that's why I think if you listen to Generation Swine, you hear that no matter what. It's like they were telling John, like, oh, John, you should try to be more like Bowie for this one. Or, John, you should try to be more like, you know, Rob Zombie on this one. You know, they were throwing a lot of ideas. And when at least when you listen to Motley 94, it's a definitely a consistent-sounding record. You know, it has a nice look. We talked about it. I mean, they go different directions, but it seems cohesive. Don't get me wrong. I'm going to just put this out there. I do like Generation Swine. I'm one of these whack jobs that actually likes this album. I just think I'm a sucker.
I've heard you say that in the past. I've heard you say that. I will give you that.
Yeah, so I've always liked this album. Probably because at that time when it came out, I was kind of getting into different kinds of styles too. I didn't mind electronic music and different things. So when Motley Crue was dabbling in these styles, I really didn't mind it. But I think when I go back and listen to it, I can kind of pinpoint, oh, sounds like they're trying to be Stone Temple Pilots on this one. This one, they're trying to be Pantera. You know what I mean? Like, I can feel like I can find the songs where they're trying to be, you know, somebody else. So it's a little frantic.
Yep.
It's a little all over the place, but I do like it. I feel like there are a few songs that I'd like to remove off of it. But you know, Vince, I give him credit. I know he doesn't like that album. He doesn't like Generation Swine. But there's certain songs that I think really work with him on it. Rat Like Me, Generation Swine. I think there are Afraid is super cool. So I don't know how much of that was kicking around when John was in the band. I know there's some YouTube videos of him doing Let Us Pray. You can find that, but I don't think it's the same lyrics, but it's the same music. It's something about it was different from what I remember.
Yeah, Swine sounds disjointed to me.
Yeah,
I mean, and I think that's a good word. I think, you know, in the dirt, Karabi at some point ends his contribution in the book by saying, make up your fucking mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, I think being pushed and pulled, and then you've got, you know, lawyers and Elektra executives, you know, making phone calls and pushing Vince around. And, you know, it's not like Vince went out and had his solo album was actually pretty cool, but it's not like he set the world on fire either.
No,
so.
No. And it sounded like, from what I'm reading, is that Elektra would not put any money into Generation Swine unless Vince was the singer on it. And I think it was a real negotiation between the two managements because, you know, Vince's management was basically knowing that, you know, this guy really can't do anything without the crew commercially. The crew kind of knew they couldn't do anything commercially without Vince, and they were going to try to give it a go. I think probably by the time they got to the 2000s, when they got to New Tattoo, and I think they were really becoming more of a touring act, and they did some pretty big tours with, like, you know, Megadeth and a lot of those metal bands opening up for them. So I feel like Crew kind of weathered the storm and then kind of got more of back to a legendary status, or, you know, like a legacy band as they got into the 2000s. But the 90s were a rough go for them, for sure.
Yeah, a rough go for a lot of the bands we'd like.
Now, one thing I will say is that Motley Crue were not pervious to the grunge saturation. So I feel like if you listen to Uncle Jack, I believe there are some bends in Uncle Jack. There are also some harmonies that are Alice in Chains-ish on Dropping Like Flies. So I feel like there are a few touches of what's going on in music. You with me on that or what?
I'm totally with you. I just don't think the 89... feel good. You can't pass that off in 94.
Right.
Times have changed. I mean, Nirvana, Soundgarden, Alice in Chains, all those bands, they just, you know, it basically was a copycat version of the mid to late 80s, where everybody wanted a Poison, mm-hmm. or they wanted a new, the new version or the newest band, and people were getting record deals that one out after the other. And I think that was basically the same with mid 90s. This sound, kids, you know, brings up a point. I don't understand where these people went. I mean, yeah, 89 sold millions of copies, and then Vince's solo album and the Motley 94 album sell gold, you know, right. 500,000 each.
Yep.
You know, where did 5-6 million people go in a span of 3 or 4 years? And you can't tell me that, well, they all grew up. I just don't buy that.
No.
I just don't know where these people went.
Well, I think I kind of know where some of them went. I think when you get that big, you've got a lot of fake fans, right? You got they're not with you for the duration. They haven't been with you because obviously 6 million appeared in 89, but if you go back a couple albums, that didn't sell 6 million. So you've got some new fans that kind of jumped in. They're fickle. They'll go with whatever's on the radio. Motley Crue's not on the radio yeah. anymore, so now they don't know Motley Crue has a new album. You know what I mean? So I feel like those are the kind of fans that were attracted with Feel Good, but they weren't diehards like you and I that are going to stick with you through thick and thin. So when you commercially tank, same thing with Kiss, and I think I'm going to bring up a few Kiss correlations here in a second. This is what happens. You're left with your diehards, okay? Now, all right, so here's the thing about Kiss and Motley Crue. I feel there's a lot of correlations between these two. And the thing that happened to Motley Crue that was so unfair was they came into a new era of music that is totally unlike what the era that they came from, right? Motley Crue are the poster children of
yep.
partying, decadence, girls, all this kind of stuff. And now it's like, you got to be serious. You got to be deep, man. There's songs like Jeremy out there. You know what I mean? And there's a lot going on. Kiss got lucky. Kiss basically created hair metal, right? Let's face it. They're the forefathers of hair metal. Same thing with Van Halen. So when the 80s yep. come in, yeah, Kiss had to change a little bit, but that's really what they always have done. You know what I mean? That's just that they're just doing their thing, man. Poison is influenced by Kiss. All these bands that are big are, you know, influenced by Kiss. So Kiss could kind of fit right in, and people were accepting of it. But with Crue, there's no way that if you're a Nirvana fan that you're going to see what Motley Crue's got going on. It ain't happening.
No, and I think people tend to forget how big radio and MTV, to a certain extent VH1, but MTV playing the videos, you know, every hour, on the hour. Headbangers Ball was always got pretty good ratings. But radio and MTV support dried up. It just withered on the vine right. in a span of about a year. And you had to seek out new albums and new videos and new music, per se. And I think that's, you know, to have it, you know, pushed down your throat is one thing, but, you know, how hard is somebody going to go looking for a new Motley album if they haven't seen them since 89, you know?
Yeah. So let's run a couple scenarios. Let's run a couple what ifs, and I want to get your opinion on this. What if this album comes out with Vince Neil on vocals? Let's say Karabi's just a writer or something. I don't know. Who knows? Let's say this album comes out, Vince is still in the band. Does it sell better, or does it not even matter?
I don't see how Vince would pull off those vocals, to be honest with you.
Right.
I think with Vince there, I think Nicky writes an entirely different album, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't see how he could pull that off. You know, I keep hearing the stories. You kind of mentioned it, you know, what if Vince was the lead singer? What if they called it something else or a new album?
Yeah.
I don't know, man. You've got a known brand, you know, Motley Crue. That's as probably as solid of a beginning as it goes.
Right.
But the times were so different, and it's just the span of a few years, the times were just 100% upside down from what, you know, I think they had remembered. I would not want to hear Vince sing that album, and I really don't think it should have been called anything else. I mm-hmm. think in 1994, that was Motley Crue.
Yeah. No, I agree, and I think with things like that, you know, you can look at everybody. Look at Kiss the Elder, or when Stryper, you know, did just a regular album. Those are kind of like, I call them like nuggets or gems in somebody's catalog. You know, in retrospect now, the Crabbie 94 album is a great, nice little thing to have. You know, I mean, you can go back on it now and be more objective. No matter what your feelings were, you can go back and say, well, that's just a great album. It doesn't matter that it was in the middle of the grunge era or Vince Neil left or whatever the problem is, you know. That's all been passed, and now you can just take the album for what it's worth, you know. And I think that hindsight is always good, and years away from situations are always good. But I think with – so I don't – so a couple points. I think if you got Vince there, and even if you did a different album, I think it probably sells a little better than maybe without Vince, because I think Vince had a lot of fans. You know what I mean? I think it was pretty clear that Vince, you know, was a big piece of Motley Crue. I think they underestimated. That's my opinion. I think they underestimated how much of a part of Motley Crue that he was. Yeah. I think they thought they could do it just like Van Halen and so many others did, but once again, you're going into a different kind of situation. You know, Kiss and Van Halen and everybody else didn't have to go through this grunge thing where whatever they were doing before is looked at as, you know, being cheesy or horrible or whatever. You know, let's play this one. Okay, so I kind of get what people say when they say, what if they called it something different? Okay, so let's play this one out. You could have did this as a side project. Okay, you put this out and then, you know, maybe regroup a few years later back with Vince. But once again, man, Fish, I'm telling you this. You're still the guys from Motley Crue doing a side project, right? Everybody still, for the most part, just doesn't want to hear about Motley Crue anymore. You know what I mean? That stuff is sailed. They don't want to hear it called some other thing or whatever. They're still the guys from Motley Crue. So I think that stigma's still there. What do you think?
For us, it feels like a brand new band. I mean, there was actually talk about changing the name of the band because we didn't want to have these conversations, you know? But our record company's greed factor kicked in, and they do kind of got us for a few more contracts.
So. I would agree with, I mean, Nikki, Tommy, and Mick. If, even if Vince does not stand in the picture, you look at those three guys and go, that's Motley Crue.
Yeah.
Vince could not even be there, but that's who they are, and I think that's an interesting point. You know, I still think Motley is Motley, and I would have put it out under the name Motley Crue, and,
yeah,
you know, let everybody figure it out otherwise.
You made a great point, and I agree with you 100%. Why would you want to start from scratch? You still got that name Motley Crue. Now let's go backwards to what we were talking about earlier. They just came off their biggest album. Why would the band that was just the biggest rock band on tour and on MTV just a couple years ago, why would we just shit-can this whole concept and start something new? It doesn't make any sense. And you've just sold a freaking big-ass, you got a big-ass contract under that name. So Motley Crue didn't have a lot of options to experiment at this point. You know what I mean? With names and all this kind of stuff. I think they had to give it a go as Motley Crue and make the best of it, you know?
100%. 100% agree. I don't think Elektra's going to sink that kind of money into, you know, Nikki's Bride of Destruction or whatever.
Right,
you know,
I think it's
Motley Crue, and for better or worse, they forged ahead, and I still don't understand the non-sales of this album. Every time that album comes up, now, you know, I'm going to be somewhere in that conversation,
yep,
but there is such an appreciation for 1994. Anytime it's brought up, there's 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 people comment, that's a great album, Motley's best,
yep,
Robbie was great. You know, I think you mentioned this earlier, it's kind of, you know, retroactively, you can listen to it and go, damn, that really sounds good.
Right.
And maybe it was just too much of a shock up front for people to get, you know, but also times they were a-changing, as they say.
Yeah. This is an interesting one that I like to throw out there. Funny enough, I think I actually did a Photoshop of it, and some rock website picked it up. But Sebastian Bach obviously sounds like he tried out, or there was talks, whatever. I don't know if I would have really cared for that pairing personally, but I would like to have seen what they could have did commercially, because you're getting, I mean, obviously Bach was a way bigger name than John Karabi. And,
yep,
you know, he's definitely had his own following he could bring. Backside of it, he's also a poster child of 80s metal. So I don't know. I mean, they did a real good job with Slave to the Grind. I mean, they really changed themselves from one album to the next, and they were playing with Pantera and all that kind of shit in 91. So if Crew could have got him, I just, once again, one of those what-ifs, it would have been cool to see what they could have done commercially. Could they have, at least sales-wise, you know, did a little better or survived a little longer, you know, without Vince? I don't know.
It's an interesting question. You know, the Skid album came out in 89, early 89, if I recall, and they kind of missed the 85, 86, 87 Bon Jovi-ish era.
Yep.
And they really, like you say, they really, and maybe this was Sebastian's preference, but they were always, you know, a little harder, a little more rockier, a little more outspoken about things. I mean, I know there was a lot of controversy with some of the, shirts he wore and, you know, and some of the fights and stuff with bands and fans and all that. But the Skids kind of escaped that. You're right. They were playing festivals with Pantera. It's an interesting concept. I know there was some other names that tried out for the band.
Yep. Let's talk about the tour a little bit, because the tour obviously was just about as ill-fated as the album was, but I thought it was a great tour. I know you saw it too. I saw it in upstate New York, and at the show that I went to, it was Typo Negative, King's X, and Motley Crue, and what a killer triple bill for that year, you know what I mean? And here's the weird thing, let me tell you this. So I want to say three years before that, I went to Operation Rock and Roll at the same venue, and it was Judas Priest, Alice Cooper, Motorhead. I mean, we're talking, you know, this was a whole different animal, right? And that place was freaking mobbed, right? I mean, there's people all over the freaking place. And then when I went to see Motley Crue, I got to admit, I was shocked, because it was not even remotely as packed as that show. What do you think?
Well, you know, it was a weird time. You know, it was an odd time. It was changing. Yeah, I mean, all the Motley, you know, Motley's whole career was about excess, over the top, you know, and then all of a sudden all these bands started coming out of Seattle that were the antithesis of that, you know, and it was rough, man. It was weird. Like, concert tickets were weird, but it wasn't just weird for Motley. It was weird for everybody.
Right.
You know, Bon Jovi, Def Leppard. God, I remember doing a show in Jacksonville, Florida, and we played a basketball arena, and there was like 2,000 or 3,000 people in like a 15,000 seat arena, and we were like, oh man, what's going on? But it was funny. Richard Marx was playing right across the street in the theater, and he probably only had 400 or 500 people there in like a 2,000 or 3,000 seat theater.
Right.
So it was just a weird time for everybody. You know, they got through it. They did my record, and then they brought Vince back, and they got through it. And, you know, obviously look at them today. They're doing great business.
But it was really cool to hear Karabi do the Vince songs. They broke down and did that little acoustical piece where they did, like, Love Shine and Home Sweet Home and all that kind of stuff. What was the attendance like when you saw them?
I went back and looked at this. I saw them July 3rd of 94. In Charlotte with an outdoor arena. I recall attendance being pretty good, but I was kind of in awe. This was really the first time I had ever heard the songs of Typo Negative. And they were quite a bit different than, say, you know, Faster Pussycat opening up for Motley at 89. So in 94, we have Typo Negative came out, just, you know, those army green shirts and black guitars, bass, drums, just very, very different. You know, King's X, very technical band, very good band, but, you know, really appealed to a certain audience. I don't think either of those helped the attendance.
Right.
But there again, you know, Motley can't bring out, you know, a second version of Warrant with them.
No.
Not at 94.
We talk about how everybody loves this album today and thinks fondly of it. Some of the members think fondly of it, right? Mick Mars always says nice things about it. Tommy Lee has said great things about it. Nicky seems to bash it a little bit. He's got a little bit of issue with Karabi. I don't know why. But we're 2 years away from a 30th anniversary. Do you think this thing gets a reissue? Because I'm sure there's all kinds of stuff out there that you could add to this. And for those people like yourself and myself who find this era, you know, cool and fascinating, I mean, I'd be all over a 30th anniversary package of this reissue. What do you think they'll even acknowledge it?
Take my money. take my money. There's some import CDs. There's some CD singles. You know, I found a bunch of stuff, whatever I could find with some of the extra tracks. But I believe it's the tour program, which I have apparently is a collectible, you know, wherever there's Electricity Tour 94. But the tour program I bought, and in it, if I'm not mistaken, there is a picture that shows song titles. And there must be 25 song titles. You know, even bits and pieces. I don't know how, you know, obviously 12 made the album, but you know, there's three or four that are floating around, you know, not even including Quaternary.
Yep.
But yeah, I would be all over that. I don't quite understand the disdain that Nicky has for the album. You're right. Tommy and Mick are all about it. I think, Karabi was working on the solo album with Mick Mars.
Yep.
And Tommy, I think, was just having a good time. I just think he was just having a hell of a time. I don't know. Maybe it's part of not hurting Vince's feelings to, you know, kind of put down that album a little bit. But I just don't think Shout is probably close, but I don't think there's anything in their catalog that compares this song by song.
Yeah. Now, what would be interesting is we didn't mention this earlier, but when I interviewed Stephen Chereau from Kick Tracy, he kind of got into a lot of detail about, you know, trying out for Motley Crue. And he said they were in a studio, and I would assume some of this might have been even recorded. Could you imagine if they've got some footage, video, audio, anything of like Stephen Chereau doing Livewire, right? Or you know what I mean? Like how killer, what a time capsule from this era that they could put out, if it even exists. I don't know. But I mean, I'm telling you, it could be really killer. And think about the Karabi stuff from Generation Swine, which was going to be called Personality Number 9. There's a lot of that. That's kind of, some of that's hit YouTube, you know. So there's stuff, man. There's even song titles that have been thrown out of the material they were working on with Vince. Footage of songs with Vince before he left the band and Karabi came in. So, man, if you could somehow compile all that stuff, that would be like a freaking box set. That would be some fascinating shit.
Yeah, I think probably stretching a little much for a box set. Probably you could put a double CD out, and I'd be all over it. You know, I think you could remaster, remix those 12 songs. Although they don't need much, but I'm sure you have an extra album's worth of outtakes.
Yep.
You know, half songs, full songs. You know, put all the songs that are on the Japanese release, and put all the ones that were some of the, you know, Baby Kills and some of the Hypnotized and stuff like that. Yeah. That are kind of hard to find unless you're really looking for them. But I'm with you that there's, I think there's more to it. And I just, you know, the positivity this album received really upon any mention, I think is proof that it's held up pretty well through the years.
Well, man, I think we covered a lot of ground, a lot of what ifs, try to make sense of all of it. And it was great talking to you in person, not just on Twitter. And I'm so glad that you got to share your love of this album with everybody, man. It's really cool.
Man, I appreciate being on, man. Feel honored. Feel honored.
Well, that was great, talking some Motley 94 with A. Fish. Power to the music, people. Rock on!